Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Franz at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with two guests, both of them here from the University of Illinois, who for a number of years now, on and off, going back to the early 80s, have spent time in Ivory Coast. Now, this is a country that at one time would have been said to be maybe one of the most stable and most prosperous countries in West Africa. And that perhaps began to change maybe as long ago as the early 1980s and has gone through a good deal of civil and political unrest since, including a war back in 2002 that split the country in half between the north that was controlled by rebel forces and the south that was held by the government. Last spring, March 2007, an agreement was signed, a peace agreement was signed between the government and the rebels, and there is some hope now that that would really mean the end to 5 years of war. Rebels are starting to give up their arms. There is an election scheduled for later this year, and perhaps it remains to be seen just how all of that will work out. We'll be talking this morning here with Tom Bassett and Carol Spindell. Tom's professor of geography here at the University of Illinois, and he's been doing fieldwork in Ivory Coast for a number of years, really since the early 1980s. Carol ended up going there because of Tom. She is an adjunct lecturer in English here at the University of Illinois and teaches creative nonfiction, teaches nonfiction writing. She's written two books. One is Dancing at Halftime, which looks at the controversy surrounding American Indian mascots in sports, and an earlier book that was based on her experiences there living in Ivory Coast, a book titled In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove, which is still in print and is a good book, by the way.
Out of print, but readily available on the online used book market.
Okay. Well, and apparently, as I have just learned here now, talking with them a little bit before we got going, she's thinking about writing another book that would, since be a more recent updating of that, the same kind of thing. So you can maybe look forward to that sometime soon. We asked them if they, because they had just recently been in Ivory Coast, we asked them if they would come in, sit down and talk a little bit about their experiences. We'll try to talk a little bit about what daily life there is like and review a little bit of the history of the country so that you can get a better understanding about maybe what's going on there over the past couple of decades at least. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you to have us.
I really appreciate you being here. We've talked over the years about this and some other things. Certainly here, you know, here on the program, we have tried, at least from time to time, to talk about Africa because we feel like it's way undercovered and people here in this country don't hear enough about it and don't know enough about it. And so we try to take the opportunity now and again to do that. And I suppose in part, I guess that's my interest in having you guys here and to talk a little bit, at least about this particular part of Africa where you all have spent a goodly amount of time over the past couple of decades. Just start us out, Tom. What should the basic things people know about Côte d'Ivoire, about Ivory Coast, just to start?
Well, probably the part of the chocolate that they eat daily, if they eat chocolate daily, comes from the Ivory Coast. The Ivory Coast is the number one producer of cocoa in the world and ranks number in the top five for coffee. It's also one of the major cotton producers of Côte d'Ivoire, of the world.
Yeah. So this was, I mentioned the fact that, you know, for at least for, say, maybe about the 20 years, the first 20 years after independence, the country did very well, and I think, as I understand it, that was largely on the strength of agricultural exports of those kinds of products that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Right. It did pretty well, especially in the 1970s, and borrowed lots of money for other development projects from the World Bank and other donors. And when world market prices began to tumble in the 1980s, it entered a protracted, really, economic crisis that in many ways continues, although it's kind of like up and down. This is the way it goes with primary commodities, the boom-bust cycle. Actually, coffee prices, cocoa prices are up. Even cotton, believe it or not, is up these days. But politically, there was a president. This is, to remind you, this is a former French colony. that became independent in 1960. And Houphouët Boigny was the president at the time, and he was the only president until he died in 1994. So that tradition, which Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe seems to be reliving again. And since then, the country has experienced some political instability. In particular, in 1995, then again in 2000, when one of the main political candidates was not allowed to run for office because of machinations of other political leaders. And this led to lots of resentment among Northerners because he comes from the North and represents Northerners in many ways. And basically, in 2002, we had a rebellion that divided the North from the South. And I would say that that was in large part due to the marginalization of the North politically.
Yeah. Well, this also, I think, has to do with the political approach of the man who was president after Houphouët Boigny, Henri Bédi, who was the guy who really practiced, I guess, what we would call maybe a politics of exclusion, where he said, you know, what's really important, the people who really matter, the people who ought to be running this country are the people who were born here in the Ivory Coast. He really stressed something he called, ivoriness in a sense, and marginalized a lot of people who were living in Ivory Coast who had not been born in Ivory Coast. Particularly, I guess that would be people from Burkina Faso, which is the country right to the north, who no doubt would have been a lot of the people who were living in the northern part of the country. And this kind of politics of exclusion or marginalization, maybe those divisions that were there were there before, but I'm sure that it made them much worse.
You know, the population of Cote d'Ivoire is 16, 18 million people, and about a quarter of them are foreign-born from Burkina Faso, as you indicated, and from Mali. And they've been critical to the success of the agricultural economy, mainly laborers. But also over time, they have acquired land to cultivate their own coffee and cocoa. And in fact, they have been allowed to vote in previous elections. Houphouët Boigny gave them the franchise so that they would vote for him, even though it was often just a one person running for office. And in the early 1990s, when multi-party democracy was introduced, they lost that vote. And now this Ivorianness is interesting. They call it Ivoirite in Côte d'Ivoire, in the Ivory Coast. And how it's been translated politically is that to be a candidate for national office, not only must you have been born in the country, but also your parents. And so that was written into the Constitution, I think specifically to exclude Alassane Ouattara, whose father purportedly was born in Burkina Faso. So that that politics of exclusion was very much behind the divisions that led to the rebellion.
Mm-hmm. So just to skip forward here now in the spring of last year, I think it was March 2007, there was an agreement that was signed between the government that had been holding the North and the rebels that had been holding the other way around. Government in the South, rebels in the North, and an agreement to try to move forward. We have new government. The man who was the leader of the rebels actually became the prime minister. And there, at least as far as what I read, there's supposed to be an election in the fall. So now I suppose the big question is, well, how does this move forward? And do they manage to, in a sense, try to put the country back together and get these two major factions that were fighting at least for a couple of years after 2002, to work together and to form a government?
Right. You're referring here to the so-called Ouagadougou Accords of March 2007. And we've just had the first-year anniversary of that. So there has been quite a bit of assessment. How far have you progressed? Mind you that when the current president, Laurent Gbagbo, came to power in 2000 under very contested conditions, his mandate was for 5 years. So that means he should have stepped down in 2005, or there should have been new elections in 2005. And that's been another source of division and tension in the country. He's still president. The Ouagadougou Accords basically provide a path towards reunification that involves the demobilization and disarmament of the rebels and their reinsertion into civilian life. That's what's going on right now as we speak. That's one part. Then the second part of the accord has to do with the holding of elections. And that is also very, you know, contested in terms of who's going to control that process. Will it be fair, transparent? And so far, so good from what I can see in terms of the involvement of the particular parties within Cote d'Ivoire that will be involved, but also the United Nations has a strong presence in Cote d'Ivoire, and they will be certifying the process, not just the results, the process. So, and that seems to be a very kind of positive point that we realized when we were there this past March and April. They have a very strong presence, and we spoke with these individuals on the Electoral Commission and were encouraged.
I want to bring Carol into the conversation and just give you the opportunity to, in a general sort of way, to talk about what kind of place this is, and maybe starting with, you know, how it is that you first started to learn about the country and feel sort of at home there and get to know people and get to know the place.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, that is so important because I think most Americans have very little idea of what daily life is like in Africa. Of course, Africa is a huge continent, and I can really only tell you what daily life is like in one village, in one part of one country. But anyway, I would like to talk about that. And Tom first went there to do research for his doctorate in 1981, and I came 7 months later. I had already traveled in Africa and really wanted to come back. I kind of was trying to persuade him to do research in Africa, actually.
It's because of Carol that actually I was there. It's not because that I was there. She was there.
Right. Luckily, I did finally persuade him that this would be a great place to do research and a really interesting place to be. And because I really wanted to go back and live in a village. I really saw traveling around that the heart of African life is in the villages. And if you want to really understand it, you've got to go there, live in a village, learn the language, and get to know the people. So we did this in a village in northern Ivory Coast called Katiali. It's a very large village. There are now 3,000 people there, but it's quite isolated. And they are subsistence farmers. They grow their own food. They do various other things to have a little cash. They grow cotton has been the main thing. And we went there, and they were very generous and welcoming to us. And we lived there for over a year the first time, and that's the stay I wrote my book about. In 1984, we weren't sure if we would ever go back. We didn't know when we left what, you know, our lives would hold. We went back. Tom wrote a dissertation. I wrote a book. Couldn't get it published at first. Publishers said Americans aren't interested in an African village, which, you know, I really thought was not going to be the case, and I turned out to be right, but it took a long time to persuade them. I went back in 1984. I was leading a group of American students to Africa. I went back to the village, and there had been 2 years of drought, and they were so delighted that I came back, and I realized, you know, how deeply I cared about these people and how connected they felt to me, that I had done the right thing. I had returned to greet them. And after that, we began to go back quite regularly. And we took our two children there. We took our son first when he was one. We took him last when he was a junior in high school in 2002, 6 weeks before the rebellion broke out. We've taken our daughter a number of times. So it had been 5 years, though, since we'd been there, and we really weren't sure what we'd find.
Our guests here this morning in this barn of Focus 580, Carol Spindell, Tom Bassett. Carol has taught here at the University of Illinois since 1989. She teaches nonfiction writing, and this book that she mentioned is In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove. That's about her, this initial experience that she had when she and Tom were living in Ivory Coast. Sadly, is no longer in print, but go to the library, go to the used bookstore, and you can find it. Tom Bassett is professor of geography. He's particularly interested in the geography of developing countries in Africa and in political ecology, and he's done over the years a lot of field work in Ivory Coast. And questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. I would think, just for me, not having had this kind of experience, that it might be difficult. And, you know, perhaps if you had spent some time in Africa even before you spent this year living there, maybe that would have helped. How did you do that? I mean, how really do you start to learn about and fit in with a place where it's just very, very different from what you'd lived in before?
It is very different. You have to have a sort of a sponsor in the village, and we're very lucky in ours. His name is Donnie Songhi, and he agreed to act as – it's a formalized relationship there in the Dula language. He's our jatigi. He's our sponsor, so he sort of adopts us. He gave us a house to live in the first time, very nicely, in a nice circular way. This time when we came back after almost 6 years away, our own house – we have a house in this village. It's round, has thatch roof. It was. When we didn't come for over 5 years, it collapsed. Collapsed, and there was nothing left. We couldn't stay there. And Doni Songhi's son, Tenena, offered us his house. Now, Doni Songhi's son, Tenena, was a little kid the first time we went to the village. And now he's a grown man. He has three wives. He's a farmer. And he had a very nice house, and we stayed there this time. So conditions are, you know, there's an ironic thing going on, because compared to how they live, we live very well when we're there. We have all these gadgets. We have cameras, and we have water filters, and we have, you know, we have enough money to eat meat every night. So we think we're kind of really roughing it, and we, you know. But they think we live very well compared to how they live. So there's a huge difference in standard of living.
Tom, what is your professional interest here? I mean, what are the problems or the areas that you were really interested in when you were there?
Well, I have a number of projects that I'm juggling. You know, I've written a book on cotton in Africa and West Africa, and kind of a social history and agricultural history. And cotton, as Carol indicated, is the main cash crop, main source of revenue for households in this area. So I'm very interested in how that economy is evolving. And, of course, there's lots of controversy right now over U.S. agricultural subsidies to the cotton sector and how that is depressing world market prices and so, therefore, the incomes of my neighbors in Kachiali. So I'm interested in those kinds of – that economic globalization, really. Mm-hmm. And how my neighbors are integrating themselves in that sense. Another one of my interests is land tenure. In 1998, the government of the Ivory Coast passed a law requiring farmers to seek title to their land. Now, this is a country in which less than 1% of the land, in fact, is privatized, in which, for which there are titles. Now, this is a project, one could say, that's been pushed by the World Bank. It's part of the sort of neoliberal world we live in, that and the privatization of everything is the way forward. So I'm interested in, and of course, the logic behind this is that once a farmer has title to land, that he or she will now have the security to invest in it and improving it, and that in turn will lead to environmental conservation and increased productivity. So these are economic sort of concepts and models that are sort of hatched elsewhere and sort of parachuted into places like Northern Cote d'Ivoire. And so I'm interested in, you know, well, how is this all going to play out here? Because, of course, there already is an existing land rights system. The people do control land and distribute it, and people have access to it. And actually, the system seems to work quite well. Cotton, for example, has been taking off for the past 25, 30 years here, and without land privatization, what's the problem? Well, anyway, I'm interested in seeing how that land law will be applied, and then what will be the repercussions? Will environmental conservation take place? Will increased productivity take place or not? So that's another topic that I've been doing research on, and there's others. I'll be happy to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of the things that I'm really interested in, it does have to do with how it is that the global economy affects life for people who live in a place like this. And this was, in fact, Ivory Coast was one of those places that this past spring we saw unrest. We saw demonstrations about the price of food. Mm-hmm. We saw it other places in Africa. We saw it some places in Latin America. We saw some places in Asia, which led to – and this was a period where I think maybe more than before have led to some really intense discussions about, well, what affects the price of food, and in what way is this all connected in a global sort of sense? Do people there, how do they think about their involvement in the global economy? Surely it's something that they do in fact have to think about.
They think about it a lot. Actually, the agricultural subsidies are a topic of recurring conversation. Hmm. The farmers that we are, that are our neighbors, of course, in the north, they produce their own food. In some ways, they see the inflation of food price a good thing because they can sell their crops at a higher price. Right. So their perspective on this is a little different than the consumers in Abidjan, the main city, or Korogo, even just 60 kilometers away, where people have seen the price of a sack of rice go up from 12,000 CFA to 15,000, 16,000 CFA. It's, you know, 25% increase, significant.
Just in the 3 months that we were there, it was going up that quickly. So, yeah, people who live in a town who have to buy their food, who maybe only have, you know, informal employment or one person in the family holding a job, they might be trying to send kids to school and so on, those people are really hurting.
And so who did they think is responsible for that? Or do they, other than perhaps blaming their own government somehow, or the guys who are elsewhere in the country who are farmers, what do they say about that?
Well, it depends on who you speak with again. You know, I think the understanding of that in the village is quite limited, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, access to news is very limited. Even us, we had our shortwave radio. All that we listened to really was the BBC and French radio, and we have a very European understanding of the past 2 months.
We know a lot about Zimbabwe and what was going on there, but yeah, there was very little other international news.
I think the demonstrations that took place in Abidjan were directed at the government because, of course, that's what the citizens will do, of course, is seek some relief, some kind of entitlement. And I think that's what the government did, in fact. They froze prices at a certain level for oil, for sugar, for rice. And that appeased people. So without understanding necessarily I mean, there is an understanding with my colleagues at the university, of course, that the price of oil has gone up and this has increased the cost of producing food, and that there may be some link between bioethanol production. And we saw that recently last year in Mexico, where there were demonstrations around the increasing price of tortillas, right? So the people are making these connections. But I still think that we're all trying to make them, too. I mean, there's this article on the front page in the New York Times today focus on hoarding, they call it, which I'm not sure is the right word, but governments have decided to limit exports because they're trying to look after their own population, right? And so when does food security somehow be called hoarding? That's an interesting term to use. But so there's of course, that's contributed to countries like India, like China, that have been major exporters of grain in the world market have decided to limit their exports. So there's a general understanding among people who have access to news of some of these forces, but it depends, again, it's kind of a situated knowledge, right? Yeah. Where are you in this world? And as I said, the farmers look upon this as being a potential boom.
Our guest in this part of Focus 5 Haiti, Tom Bassett and Carol Spindell. Tom's a professor of geography here at U of I. Carol is a writer. She's also adjunct lecturer in the English department. And we're talking about some of their experiences on and off over the years, particularly just this past spring in Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, in West Africa. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller to bring into the conversation here. Champagne, line one.
Oh, hi. Mm-hmm. Carol, I was wondering about the daily life of the people there, like what kind of religion they have, what kind of food they eat, and the relationship with women. So you said one of them had three wives, and was it hard to learn the language? And how do they get around? What kind of transportation? and you know, just in general, their daily life.
Okay, I'll try to draw a picture with words of the village for you. You drive there. There are dirt roads. You arrive there. There are mud brick houses. Some have thatched roofs. Some have tin roofs. The people's fields are outside the village, so women usually walk out to the fields. They farm in the rainy season. The rains start in May and go to December. They harvest their crops in December. Women work very, very hard. I mean, everyone there works very hard. They work harder in their daily lives than we would ever even consider working in this country. And women work particularly hard. A woman's day is never done there. She's a farmer. She gets up early. She has to cook and feed the family. And to cook there, you've got to first pound the rice. The rice is just harvested from the field. It's still got the husks on. You've got to put it in a mortar and pestle. You've got to pound it. Then you've got to collect the firewood. Then you've got to build the fire. Then you've got to cook the rice. You've got to grow the vegetables for the sauce. It's really a lot of work. Then after they've fed the family in the morning and fixed the lunch, they go to the fields to farm. Women are farmers there. They work in the family fields. They're growing rice. They're growing corn to eat for the family. They're also working perhaps in the family's cotton fields, so they'll have a little income if all goes well. That income will be used if someone in the family is sick and they need to send them to the clinic, or if they have a little extra money, they might be able to send one of the children to school. Most people in this village are illiterate. There is an elementary school in the village, but these are farmers, and most families can only afford to send maybe one child to school if they're doing pretty well. So it's a multi-ethnic village, which is very common in Africa. There are three different ethnic groups living in and around the village. Two of the groups practice Islam. The third group practices a traditional African religion. There are a very small number of people in the village who have converted to Christianity in the last few years. And some of the animists have also converted to Islam and go to the mosque. But they speak three different languages. One of them, they say it takes 5 years to even begin to learn. It has five tones and this complex classifying system. So Tom and I didn't even try to learn that language, although we can greet people in it. And they're always asking us, okay, when are you going to learn to speak that language, our language? But we speak Jula, which is a trade language all over West Africa. It only has two tones. I'm not too good with the tones, I have to admit. I don't have great pitch. But we do speak it. It was hard this time. We'd been away 5 years. It was really difficult. But when we're going more frequently, we can manage to get along. However, we do have a translator that works with us because we want to make sure when we write about it or when Tom does his research, we want to make sure we really get the story right in a more nuanced way.
Yeah. Well, thank you. What do they do for recreation if there's time for that?
Well, this was the great fun thing about being there in the dry season this time, because once the harvest is in December, they're farmers. They've got time to they repair their houses and they do more recreational things. One of the things they do, they're wonderful musicians and wood carvers, the Sanufo, and they have their funerals. So the person, when they die, they're buried. But their funeral, they wait to have the funeral until after the harvest when they'll have enough food to feed the guests and when they'll have enough time to dance all night for several nights and have these funerals are like a 3-day multimedia event. So we went to a lot of funerals and heard a lot of great music and did a lot of dancing because that's what you do. You to honor the person who's died, you stay up all night and dance. Tom and I would usually go to bed and then get back up at 5 in the morning and go dance some more because they were still at it. Young people play soccer in the evenings after they've done their work or after school or in the dry season. There's lots of soccer games going on in the village. Little girls play those hand clap games that you might have seen and sing. People dance. People also tell stories. Some people are really good storytellers.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. This is really, I guess, one of the things that I wanted to invite you to talk some more about, and that was how it is that you went about trying to integrate yourself into the activities of the community. And to what extent you could do that, did people really make you feel like you were part of the community?
They're incredibly welcoming and generous. I doubt we would be as welcoming if someone turned up on our doorstep, truthfully.
Well, I mean, we did a range of things that everyone else does. We went to the fields, and we helped our host, Donny Sanghi, harvest some of his cashew nuts, for example. Farmers are diversifying their farm production as cotton becomes less interesting. They've been growing a lot more cashews. So we spent some time at his orchard collecting nuts and talking to him about it. And, you know, this talking to farmers about farming is no matter if it's Central Illinois or West Africa, we can just go on and on about talking about farming.
Mm-hmm. Tom had a great recreational activity. In the evenings, he would open up his laptop and show the pictures that he had taken that day this time. And there would always be a crowd around, and people would love to talk about it. In fact, what they want us to do, and we're going to try to do this for the next time when we go back, they want us to bring back the 1981 pictures of their parents who are all gone now. And they said, oh, I know you have a picture of my father. You know, he died 2 years ago. Would you come back with it? So we're going to try to do that the next time.
Yeah. Just to shift the focus a little bit, earlier on in the program, Tom, you were giving the thumbnail sketch of politics over the last couple of decades. We certainly have seen examples in Africa of conflicts that started out being local and then became regional, and probably the big one was the one in the Congo. And maybe, you know, there are others. This particular one that you talked about that resulted in the division of the country that went on for several years between the North and the South, certainly that Burkina Faso was involved to the extent that at least that was where the peace deal was signed in the capital of Burkina Faso. Was this something that involved the surrounding countries? Did they insert themselves, or were they dragged into this conflict?
Well, yes. I mean, the role of Burkina Faso is ambiguous. Of course, the rebels came into Cote d'Ivoire from Burkina Faso. Hmm. Okay, so they had been had some kind of protection from Burkina Faso. Did they get receive funding from them? We don't know. Military training? We don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions at this point, but we know that the rebels came from Burkina Faso, and that the current president, Blaise Compaoré, has the authority to broker this peace deal. Other countries have I did speak with some of the rebels, in fact, when we were there, and asked them specifically about the role of hunters in this conflict, because I had done some research on hunting and hunters, and their increasingly national prominence as security guards and their eventual exclusion from the South because that President Bédié feared that they were going to become a militia at some point and overthrow the government. And there were reports in the early reports of the Rebellion about hunters being present. And so I did speak with hunters and I spoke with rebels and to get a sense of what was in fact the role of hunters in this conflict. And it seems that there hunters from Burkina and Mali were involved among the rebel troops. On the western side of the country is Liberia. And we know Liberia is, like the Congo, one of these conflicts that did bring in neighboring countries. For example, Sierra Leone was highly stabilized by the conflict in Liberia when Charles Taylor was president. Well, that conflict now has calmed down, and we have post-conflict development taking place there. But we have all these arms still circulating in that area and all these young unemployed men anxious to find a job. And so they've offered themselves as mercenary soldiers to both the rebels and the government, right? Depending on what side of the border they were fighting. Yeah. So we do find rebels and government mercenaries from Liberia in this conflict. And in fact, the western part of Cote d'Ivoire at this point is still, the most tense region. Mm-hmm. As part of that, because it was the most violent conflicts, in fact, occurred in that area.
Hmm. I think, you know, here, the stories we read about Africa, they are all conflict stories, and that I'm sure don't reveal anything of the subtleties and the history behind the conflict. It's just that there's conflict, so it gives you the idea. And much of Africa is conflict free. People have a lot of various kinds of problems, but it's not like the entire continent there's war going on. But because there is the focus on the conflicts that are going on, I'm sure that affects people's perception of what the whole place is like. Mm-hmm. And yet that it's hard to understand what the conflicts are really about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a political conflict. It's not a religious conflict. It is slightly ethnic because the ethnicities are somewhat different. People have ethnic allegiances, but really it's a political conflict between the northern region and the southern region, I think.
I would add that there's also an economic dimension to this. And we talked a little bit about how things, the economy was booming in the 1970s and then began to fall apart in the 1980s and 90s. And when revenue declines, that means there's in a political system in which patronage is key to winning political allies. There's less money to distribute to potential allies, and I think that the decline in prices for these major exports in the 80s and 90s had something to do with the inability of government leaders, the president in particular, to basically buy off regional opposition. So there is an economic dimension that kind of morphed into a political one when multi-party elections took place and these different leaders of the parties realized they didn't have a national following. And so this politics of division, in fact, I think became more of a political strategy at that point, where another party was described as being Muslim from the north, and this one is Christian from the center. This one is Bete, this one is Bauli. And these are unfortunate common political strategies to win votes. But as we can see, it just drives wedges through society and creates tensions and unfortunately erupts into war.
Yeah. Well, how is there some way in which this kind of thing you're talking about on a kind of a macro level plays out on the micro level to as small as the level of the individual?
Our village.
But yeah.
Well, we arrived at the village and the elders set us down and they said, "We want to tell you right away. We want you to realize this. We want you to know no one was killed here. No one was killed in our village. We want to make sure you know that." But they said, there have been so many losses because of this rebellion. We've lost so many things. We've suffered so much. We've gained nothing from it. And when you start looking at things they lost, I mean, life was already hard there, and people were struggling to get by day to day already before this political crisis. For example, when the rebels came into the village, the nurse at the clinic fled. The nurse was a southerner. So now they had no health care. The clinic was empty. The teachers, they didn't get their salaries from the South. So they stayed on for a while and they lived on handouts from the villagers. But the villagers really can't afford to feed the teachers and support them. And eventually they left. And then the school became kind of erratic. People volunteered and they tried to keep it going. But that was really difficult. There were young people in the village who had done well in school and had done well on tests and exams. They were supposed to go south for higher education. Really important to educate this next group of leaders to get people actually employable. None of them were able to go for 5 years. It's like a generation lost of young people. So just on and on, all these little things. People couldn't get their crops to market. There's a rebel barricade at the edge of the village, and every bus that goes through, the rebels tax. They make the driver pay, and they make the people on the bus sometimes pay. So all the little economic ways that people make money, they're having to support the rebellion at the same time. But the rebels don't put any of that money back into like roads or health care or schools. They don't support any of that. They don't maintain any of that.
It's a, as Carol mentioned earlier, it's a multi-ethnic village. There are the Sanufo, there are Jula households, there are Fulani households, and there are immigrants from other parts of West Africa that give it a real cosmopolitan quality to it. But they get along, and they're Muslims, they're Christians, they're animists, there's people that don't believe in anything, that they get along. I mean, the Muslims don't like the Sanufo pigs wandering through their quartier, and I'm with them, you know.
Tom had a slingshot, and when pigs came in our courtyard, they were not welcome.
So the community gets along, I think, pretty well. Mm-hmm. That said, while we were there, the village was designated as a rural commune. That is, status has gone up from a village to, in fact, a...
like a township or something.
And ultimately, there'll be a mayor, and there will be a council of elected representatives from different neighborhoods. And so talking with our neighbors about that, well, who do you think will be mayor? Will you run for mayor, et cetera, you know? And of course, all of our Sanufo neighbors said, well, it's going to be a Sanufo, of course, right? I mean, it's our village.
We founded the village. We were the first inhabitants.
So is that Ivoirite or is that, you know, a longstanding tradition? I say it's a longstanding tradition of the Sanufo are the founders of the village. They are the landholders. If you are a jeweler or a Sanufo and you want to cultivate land, you go speak with a Sanufo lineage head or the land priest. So it'll be interesting to see how all that works out.
Because I would always say, well, how many of the council members do you think should be women? After all, women make up half the village. And then there would always be a long, uncomfortable silence. And they would always go, oh, Carol, she always brings up things like this. What a weird idea.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guests, Carol Spindell and Tom Bassett. Carol is an adjunct, adjunct lecturer in English department here at U of I, where she's taught for a number of years. She teaches nonfiction writing, and Tom is a professor of geography. And we're talking about some of their experiences on and off in Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, and West Africa over a long period of time, going back to the early 80s. When they were there first. Carol's written a nice book about that, which is sadly no longer in print. But I'm going to mention the title again, In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove. You can look for it. And they were just there recently for a couple of months after not having been there for 5 years. And we thought it'd be interesting to have them come in and talk a little bit about this place and about what it's like. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Did you have the urge, you know, I suppose there's this idea, at least in anthropology, sort of the classic idea was you go to a place and it's supposed to be hands-off. All you're supposed to do is watch. You're not supposed to get involved. But, of course, that's – I don't know if anybody has ever actually managed to do that, you know. Do you have at all the urge if you see, for example, you know, if you think women ought to have a greater voice in running the village, you know, what do you do about that other than just saying to people every once in a while, you know, what do you think about this? You know, just raising it as a topic of conversation. I mean, do you have the impulse to, if there's something that you say you think, well, you know, maybe it would be better if they, you know, whatever, did something differently, that you would suggest that to them, or that you would actually try to do a little nudging? Or do you just say, well, that's the way people do things here. I don't live here, so I have to be careful about what I do.
We are careful about mixing our own sort of biases and perspectives with our neighbors and their – so it's a tricky issue. That said, we don't want to draw a line too firm here, too rigid, in that we're all humans and have goals and certain ideas about the good life and what's just. I think that's commonly shared, in fact. I had a neighbor who drank a lot of alcohol, for example, and this kind of white lightning, locally made.
Very dangerous stuff.
And I told him, you know, I don't think that's a good idea to do that. So, and he stopped for a number of years, which was delightful. Yeah. We came back and he was still there. And unfortunately, he picked it back up again, and he's passed away.
Yeah, I had a little public health campaign going this time. Unfortunately, cigarettes have gotten very cheap in the village. They're being brought in from Guinea. So they went from being very expensive, so no one could afford to smoke, to being very cheap, so all these young men are smoking. Well, most people in this village are illiterate. They don't know about the dangers of tobacco, health dangers. So Adama, who's our translator, he would set me up perfectly. If we saw someone smoking, he would say, "Carol, by the way, do you smoke?" And I would launch into my little, "Well, actually, you should know that, da 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 da." And we have things we try to educate people about.
I have three examples of areas in which we have intervened in or have not. Mm-hmm. One was the school lunch program. This is a World Food Program funded program to provide children with subsidized food at noontime to encourage good nutrition and school attendance and good hard schoolwork. We detected corruption in that program, that some of the food coming in was being diverted by the people managing the program. We learned that, and we talked to people. There's a student-parent committee that is now in charge of this program because they also picked this up, this corruption. But we didn't think that they were doing very much about it. And so we talked to them about ways of assuming control over this program so that the kids would be eating and not the administrators. Land privatization. I do work on who owns what and where, and what are the boundaries of the village, and that knowing the boundaries of the village, and knowing the history of the village and settlement, in fact, is quite important for the implementation of this land law. I make maps. I give maps to the land priests. Say, look, based on my interviews, these are the boundaries of the territory of the village. And they've told me how grateful they are to have this map and how this map has been useful to them in the past and adjudicating disputes with neighbors. So that's interesting. Cotton policy. The cotton program is funded by the World Bank, by the European Union. I go to Abidjan and I go to these offices and I speak to the people of the World Bank and the European Union about the situation in the countryside. They have no idea what's going on in the countryside. And to give them that perspective and why the cotton economy has collapsed from the village's perspective is useful. So to answer your question, it's a fine line we walk.
Yeah. We also were able to have a dam built in the village, and we were glad to do that. We had plans for a library and a mill. We'd been meeting with the women, and they wanted to get a shea butter mill, and we had gotten a grant from the U.S. Embassy, and the check arrived in Abidjan. But again, because of this rebellion, no one from the embassy could come to the north to see the project, and the check was sent back to the state. So that was another really sad loss because of the rebellion. So we have intervened in ways like that, too.
We have one caller here. I want to try to get him before we end up out of time in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah.
My name is Rosine Yao, and I'm from the Ivory Coast.
Oh.
And I'm really happy to hear people talking about my country. And I just wanted to call to say that I've been here for 10 years in the United States. And the reason why I came is I was to go to school. And I also wanted to talk about how the war affected my country. Actually, I wasn't there when the war started, but the big problem now is people not be able to find a job because of what happened. A lot of investors left the country, so now people are trying to get a job. They will find something, but they won't get paid for it. Like my brother, he works somewhere, and I mean he can. Sometimes it doesn't get paid for like 4 months, and that's a big, big problem for a lot of people in Ivory Coast. So I just wanted to, add this comment, and so that's all I had to say.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
We're coming down to the point here. We have a minute or so left. I'm sure there are lots of things we could talk about if we could keep going. What sort of a thought would you like to leave with folks?
I don't know. I guess I would have to say that these people are remarkably resilient, and they make the best of very difficult situations. And we are a little bit hopeful. Elections are slated for November 30th. If they're able to hold elections, the country is able to stabilize and reunite, I think the economy will improve. And
Did this change your life? Do you think you're a different person for having had this experience?
I think we're better people. We try to live up to be the people that the villagers think we are.
And I guess I would say, David, that you alluded to earlier that the general public's perception of Africa is one of crisis, yeah. of conflicts, yeah. of disasters, famines, and you know, our goal is to point out the complexities of the situation, not the simplifications, and I think also to make connections between the United States and say the Ivory Coast, right? I mean, there are major corporations like ADM and Cargill that are involved in the cocoa sector, for example. The cotton subsidies in this country affect cotton prices in the Ivory Coast. We are, whether we know it or not, deeply implicated in the lives, the daily lives of people in the most remote places you can imagine. And the more that we're aware of those connections, I think the better off everyone will be.
Well, there we're going to have to finish up. Tom Bassett is professor of geography here at University of Illinois. Carol Spindell is writer and adjunct lecturer in English department. Go out and see if you can find her book, In the Shadow of the Sacred Grove. You'll have to find a used copy, but you'll enjoy it. Thanks very much for being here.
Our pleasure, David.
You're welcome. Thanks.